The Nature of Dragons by Arthur Rybak. Prologue. People are never born great, of course, but those who place the world on their shoulders and willingly carry it forward do start somewhere. Simon, an ugly man with an ugly nose and an even uglier expression on his angular face, snarls as he pushes his way through the throngs of women in summer white dresses milling about Polar's main square. They sidestep him, eyes widening in outrage. But the warm weather and summer sun stays their anger, and they quickly go back to bargaining with the vendors over wares, their giggles and chatter so loud Simon barely resists the urge to cover his ears. "I have a commission for you, Simon," Philip had said not an hour ago, as though Simon were just some servant, and not until recently his equal. Gritting his teeth, Simon banishes Philip's words, tries not to think of the prince's smile as he said them, or remember how easily he'd slid back into the familiar pattern of friendship and equality, as though Philip had not been the very first person to turn away from him when Simon had lost his fortune and title 3 years ago. "Since you and I are almost brothers, well, not brothers," a tinkling laugh, "we all know what you do to your brothers." And they had been almost brothers. With Simon, a sickly child, sent down south every year to stay with Philip and his mother during Sever's coldest months. Simon hurries around a corner and out of the scorching wind. His tunic sticks to his body where it touches flesh. His feet feel raw, swollen twice their size in his boots. His stomach roils. Then he breathes. In. Out. In. He's fine. He's leaving this horrid place. By nightfall, he'll be having dinner in the master's hall of the university, and all shall be forgotten. "I thought it only appropriate," Philip had told him as they stood in the throne room of the Polar Palace, "to go straight to you." Bloody hell. Could Simon have been more gullible? At 23, he's the youngest master spinner the University of Fahlahara has seen in over a decade, and instead of approaching Philip's summons with suspicion, he'd projected an entire future in his mind. How Philip was summoning him in order to extend a hand of friendship. He'd had imagined how he would offer Simon a place beside him, along with lands and titles, and an income worthy of his lineage and name, instead of his measly university stipend. And weaved through all that fluttering and hopeful daydreaming was the thing he wanted above all. Forgiveness. He didn't need forgiveness 3 years ago. 3 years ago, he had a throne, a family, a sizable inheritance. All doors in the lands were open to him. But all doors that are open slam shut when one is found bloody and without memory, surrounded by the bodies of their 5 carved-up siblings. "My mother," Philip had said, "make her love her, has grown old and brittle with age." Furious, Simon grabs hold of the Sila. It writhes in his grasp. He attempts to spin the air cool around himself, even as his schema unravels, shrinking and twisting away. Almost a living thing, terrified of his anger. He pulls it too tight. It snaps. His palms tingle. "What I would like from you, Simon, is for you to help her understand that it's time for her to take the time to care for herself." Simon turns onto an empty street. It's packed with dirt. Polar is more an overgrown village than an actual city, its citizens refusing to build anything higher than 2 stories. He grits his teeth, grasps for the Sila again. It slips away and is gone. Simon reaches. "You may use any means necessary to convince her," Philip went on shamelessly, "though you must resist killing her, or the others will sense a coup and it will all turn into a mess." The Sila snaps. Simon's palms burn. "I'm sure you have the necessary skills to find the right words." Colorful wooden cottages line the streets, decorated with wooden window frames carved into delicate lace patterns, meant to protect the homeowners from evil. Each one a distinct display of mastery, all done by hand, of course. Polar, Vary's capital, is one of the few cities in the lands where buildings are still being put together without the help of the Sila. It's common enough in small towns and villages, what with constructors not always being readily available, but most cities pride themselves on their fantastical, Sila-spun architecture. In Vary, it's a matter of principle, tradition and honor above all else. even comfort. Grace, there was a time when Simon had put tradition and honor first, too. He needs to get back to the room he's renting, gather his things, and in 10 minutes he will be back in his quarters in the university, just in time for a long, luxurious bath before dinner. As he gets further from the center of the city, the cottages become simpler, a little worse for wear. Simon glares at them, as though they are, each and every one, personally responsible for his foul mood. The fence he's passing gives a loud squawk. Simon jumps, swearing, and turns to face it. The wooden roosters decorating its planks sing up at the sun. Then, seeing he's noticed them, preen, shaking wooden feathers, and trill louder under the attention. Simon grimaces at them, tugging his tunic tighter around him, shielding himself from the noise. He moves closer, trying to pick out the schema animating the insipid birds. Whatever it is, its frequency is extensive. They seem half alive. He leans in, then recoils in alarm. An old woman's lined face peers at him, wide-eyed, through a gap in the fence. She has a flowery scarf tied over her wild gray hair. Her eyes are an opaque, watery blue. She grins at Simon, her sharp silver teeth gleam in the sunlight. They startle the anger right out of him. Simon hopes his horror does not show on his face, but really, the hag seems to have stepped out of a nightmare. He's heard of this. Women carving themselves up in disturbing ways during the Nurak Wars to arm themselves with weapons that couldn't be taken from them, but he's never seen it firsthand. Simon shudders. She must have been beautiful once. Soldiers always come for the pretty ones first. Finally! Finally! Can't ever run away, sweet bones! She cackles at him. Can't ever run away! And just like that, his anger returns. He's not running from Philip. He's simply refusing to tarnish his honor, what's left of it. Simon takes one step back, two, and then he's almost sprinting in his haste to get away. He's only a few streets from his room when something explodes overhead. He grabs the Sela, like one would grab a rushing torrent. It floods his body. The shining strands of a schema spun and tightened before he even registers what he's doing, blocking him from falling rubble. He jumps back as a huge beam of singed wood shatters against the barrier of Sela he's spun above himself and drops, splintered, at his feet. Dust rises, sticking to his damp flesh, and Simon stands there, sputtering and fuming. It's a wonder he got the schema up in time to avoid most of the debris. He glares up at the gaping hole in the side of a house. Through it, a small blonde boy is looking down at him, snickering. And that is it. The bloody, last drop. Simon storms round the building, going straight for the door. A few children, peering curiously around the wall, scatter at the sight of him. He ignores them and bursts in without so much as a "by your leave." The house is wider than most of the cottages that make up the city, but it has the same wooden walls as all the other houses, cluttered with framed miniatures and dried weeds braided into charms. A white clay oven is pushed up against the far corner, blankets piled high atop it, a place to keep warm when the temperature finally drops in the evening. The floor a padded-down mixture of clay, earth, and hay. He climbs the wooden stairs, two at a time, and moves down the narrow corridor with no regards whatsoever for the fact that the house belongs to someone, and that this someone may be less than appreciative of a strange, dirty man storming through their property. He opens the door to find a long, sterile room with rows upon rows of beds. The room stinks of burning, mixed with the sharp, crackling scent of a snapped schema. At the very end, near the hole in the wall, stands the child. He's glancing nervously at five boys encircling him. Simon pushes them aside and, grabbing the boy by the wrist, drags him towards the door. "No!" the boy says, squirming in his grasp. "Let me go!" His voice sharp and high, and Simon has no patience for it. "You nearly killed me, you wretched child. Do you have any idea how dangerous what you did was? Forget me," he snarls. "You nearly killed yourself. We was just standing there," the boy says, still struggling. "And boom, boom, and there's a hole. Big surprise, none of us fell through it." His distress is palpable. "We don't know who did it." And Simon would believe him, if it weren't for the schema's residue coating the little idiot, stinging Simon's palm where he clutches the child by the arm. The boy nearly topples off the crooked steps as Simon pulls him down them, righting himself only thanks to Simon's grip on his wrist. By the time they're at the bottom, he's whimpering. Two women hurry through the open door, followed by a gaggle of jabbering children. The taller of the two has mousy hair streaked with gray. It's plaited into the single braid of a spinster. Her dress is brown, her age and unwed status prohibiting her from wearing white. Her face, lined from frowning, tightens further as she gives Simon a slow, appraising look. The other is younger and beautiful, with large brown eyes and soft auburn locks escaping her long, thick braid. Once she's wed, she'll be able to turn the braid into two and wrap them round her head as a crown, as a sign of her heightened position in society. What with her delicate features and kind smile, Simon has no doubt she'll be snatched up soon enough. She puts a slim finger to her lips and, maintaining eye contact with him, gives a soft shush. All the children fall silent, as though spelled, and Simon blinks, surprised to find he too is mesmerized by her wide eyes and puckered lips. "A gentleman caller of yours, Miss Forn?" asks the old maid. "Oh, Maker grace you with his light," the young woman says to Simon instead of replying to her. She takes in his dust-covered tunic and hair. "Whatever could have happened to you, poor dear? Here, have a seat." "I strapped up some delicious fish broth this morning. It's thickening in the kitchen. Do have a bowl, while the children beat your coat for you." She gestures to an unsturdy-looking stool by the wooden table. "And I?" She gives Simon a smile and reaches out soft fingertips to run over the scrape on his forehead. He winces, but stays still, hypnotized by her voice. "We'll whip up a healing charm, and you'll be right as light post-haste." Simon frowns. Why is she being so kind? It's unnatural for an unmarried woman to give this much attention to a man of his lowly status. Surely she can see the state of him. Then he remembers the expensive embroidery on his tunic, ordered especially for his meeting with Philip, and sighs. But of course, that explains it. "I thank you for your generous offer," Simon says to her, "and apologize for entering your home uninvited, but this miscreant just blew a hole in your house and nearly left me headless." The older woman takes hold of the boy's chin and glares down her long nose at him. "What did you do this time, Dimitri?" she asks in her shrill voice. Dimitri bursts into hysterical tears. "Good. The little rat deserves to be scared. He could have brought the entire house down." Simon is so angry he thinks he can feel the room spasm. "Yes, we saw the damage from outside," she says, looking over to Simon and adjusting her gray apron. "Do not apologize, good sir. It's a good thing you came in. It would have taken us far longer to catch him without you. Let me introduce myself. I am Madame Rode. And that," she nods at the pretty young woman, "is Miss Forn." "Simon," he replies, dipping his head in a tight bow before returning his attention to Dimitri. "I demand the boy be punished," he says, sneering down at the child. Dimitri's eyes widen, his mouth opens, he gives a sob, loud and broken. And then abruptly, he stops crying. His breathing is still ragged, his face a blotchy red, but the tears are gone. And so is the fear. Simon eyes him for a moment, but a glance at the two women indicates that this reaction is nothing new. Dimitri stands completely still, glaring straight ahead of himself. The room pulses. "Punished? There will be no skin left on his back by the time I am done with him," says Madame Rode, thin lips stretching out into a smile. Who says such a thing and smiles? Simon wonders, eyes narrowing in suspicion, as he takes in the gentle faces of the women, the children's eager grins, the room with its tightly woven charms, straw dolls and tiny pouches cluttering every available surface. He blinks, thinks, something's out of place. Rode pulls the lad's shirt up and over his head. It catches on his slim neck, and Simon is almost unsurprised to see the maps of scrapes and bruises covering his torso, too many to account for even on an overly active child. "When I said I want him punished, I meant he should be put to scrubbing pots until he turns gray. The boy is an imbecile, to be sure, but no one came to any bodily harm. Restoring your wall will be a chore, though nothing a constructor can't fix in a few hours. In fact, I'll help myself, if it pleases you. Simon hates menial labor, but Grace, if he had been switched for every hole he blew in a wall, he'd have no meat left on his back. This is just what happens when children grow. They experiment with the Sela. It's frustrating for a parent, no doubt, but should be expected. Encouraged, even, if they want their child to learn self-control. It does not please us, says Miss Forn, tipping her nose into the air. Thank you very much. We shall have none of that abnormality under our roof. He will fix it by hand after his lashes. Fix it by hand? A hole of that size? Grace, girl, I couldn't fix that thing by hand if I tried, and I'm a grown man. It's either that, or work off the cost of a carpenter in the mines. And you wouldn't want that, would you, Dimitri? All that darkness and dirt. Still afraid of the dark, this one. Sylvia, she waves at a small, short-haired girl. Go fetch the cane. It seems Dimitri didn't have enough of it this morning. The girl curtsies and hurries off. How many beatings has he taken under your care? Asks Simon. Then, what is this place anyway? Which one of you is the boy's mother? I demand to speak to her. Mother? Says Miss Forn. You are in the orphanage of the Proud Mary. There are no mothers here. To Simon, it seems the room begins to hum. Where is your prayer charm, Dimitri? She asks, crouching down to the boy's level and running a finger over a red rash round his neck. Have you removed it again? No wonder your dragon has risen to the surface. The children snicker. A few whisper to each other. Forn looks around, pressing a finger to her lips a second time. Her eyes don't seem angry. In fact, the look she gives the other children can only be called playful. Well? She prompts, turning back to the boy, all signs of playfulness gone. My prayer charm was gone when I woke up, ma'am, he replies. His voice is raspy, his face sullen, eyes downturned. But there is something in his stance that says to Simon that he is ready to fight, ready to take her on. Grace. This measly creature is ready to take them all on, when Simon himself could barely do more with Philip than run from him. You little liar, she says sweetly. I can tell you haven't worn it in days. A prayer charm? Asks Simon. To protect him, she says, glancing up, and Simon finds himself once again taken aback by the sheer beauty of her. I made it for him with my bare hands. Her eyes return to the lads. I did not fear the fire roots and liars' sting so long as they kept the dragon out of you, whispered prayers into it until my voice was hoarse and throat sore, and you removed it. How is that a display of love? Dimitri, look at me, child. How is that a display of your love for me? The room shudders. Simon can practically taste the disappointment in her tone. You must be insane, he breathes. Fire root has no properties other than the heat it generates. A tiny, diluted quantity can, technically, be added into certain types of hypothermia potions and balms. Apart from that, it simply keeps burning. And lyre is poisonous. People die from prolonged exposure to it. It's for the child's own good, says Madame Rode. The fire root and lyre keep the boy's character tolerable, and the prayers keep his dragon at bay. And people call Simon a monster. Charms are superstitious rot. He grabs the boy's shirt from her and tugs the child to his side, as is the dragon for that matter. Next, you'll be telling me the white lady stepped out of a tale to raise the dragon from his pit. Good grace, he's simply spinning early. Here, he says, handing the boy his shirt. Put this on. The lad blinks up at him and pulls it on. Don't speak that cursed name in this house, says Madame Rode. The prophecies are never to be taken lightly. When the dragons walk the earth shall shake. Do you, an educated man, truly think that is a joking matter? As an educated man, he snarls, baring his teeth at her, I know that basing your reality on myths is a dangerous game. It tends to excuse all kinds of atrocities. Dimitri is using the dragon's own power, she replies. Do not look at us so. The child is unnatural. Unnatural? Grace, woman, what is wrong with you? You do this to the other children, too. None of our other children have the dragon in them, she says. We make sure of it. The room convulses. Everything that isn't nailed down lifts about an inch and begins to rotate. Simon can't see any schemas beneath the objects, but both the frequency of Sela and its volume is immense, almost more than Simon himself can hold, and he is far from weak. The raw display of power is so awing that Simon almost doesn't notice the children huddled together, shouting and pointing at the floating books and cups and chairs and charms. Simon makes quick use of their distraction, pushing one schema after the next into first the women, then all the children in the room, sounding them. His stomach churns at what he finds. Hollow. Every last one. Simon wonders at that. How they can stand. How they can live with the emptiness. Simon knows that some people are born without the ability to touch the Sela, but they are so rare that he's only ever met one in his entire life. An old, enthusiastic librarian who seemed not to even know he couldn't spin, enthralled as he was by his books. Over a dozen hollow people in a single room is simply unheard of. And Dimitri here, among them. The boy is so powerful, and stuck here, in a house full of the hollow. Simon feels it then, the tipping point, the moment when his life can go in two clear, shining directions. But there's no way to read the future. So it happens, as most things do in Simon's life. Quick, and with no way back. How much for the boy? He asks. Everything tumbles back down with a clatter, and the women turn, furious, back to Simon and Dimitri. More than you can afford, says Forn, still beautiful, even in her haughty anger. How much? 3 gold crowns, she says. 5, says Rode. It really is more than Simon can afford. Nonetheless, he counts 5 gold coins, placing them into Madame Rode's outstretched palm. He takes Dimitri by his trembling hand and leads him out of the orphanage. The boy doesn't hesitate. Do you need any of your things? Asks Simon. Dimitri shrugs a shoulder. Do you want to go back to get them?
No, they'll come.
He looks up at Simon, as though daring him to tell him off for spinning, but Simon just nods. As they round the building, a small chest of drawers wobbles its way to the hole in the wall. It tips out and falls, catches a few inches over the ground, and lands softly. The thing totters up to them on stumpy little feet. It's quite an extraordinary animation of the inanimate. Simon sounds the case of drawers, looking for any indication of the tightened lines of a schema, but finds nothing. Instead, it has the high frequency and half-alive feeling of the wooden roosters on the fence. The way you use it is dangerous, says Simon. Schemas should be spun around objects. Forcing the Sela into them can have unforeseeable consequences. It's the only way I know how. They don't let me anyway. They hate it. They're all empty. Madame Rode and Miss Forn. Most of the children they collect are empty too. Not me, of course. Someone left me. They call it being pure, but I know the truth. I know that they shouldn't be empty. That's why they hate me. Because I am better than them. Because I am whole. Simon nods, keeps nodding as he glances down at the boy. Pride is not very well liked amongst most people, says Simon after a while. He wonders if he's in over his head here. He's not sure what made him do it. He's not sure why he cares. Perhaps something in the boy's posture reminds him of his second brother. It's not like he can afford to raise a child. He can barely support himself, let alone feed a second mouth. He thinks maybe he'll give Dimitri to one of the other master spinners. But the thought of the boy being placed once more in hateful hands makes him dismiss the idea. And regardless, he despises all the other masters. He doesn't want Dimitri to grow up to be like them, a useless brat, expecting the world on a platter.
Is it pride if it's true?
Well, says Simon thoughtfully, you should be proud when you do something, when you achieve something, or build something. Your Sela, you were born with that, and they were not. They did not lose their ability to spin, nor did you work for yours. Once you do something yourself, create it, then you can be proud. Until then, you're only kidding yourself. The boy nods, and Simon thinks, perhaps he is listening. The wardrobe spits out Dimitri's clothes. They fold themselves into a canvas bag, which Simon takes from the air. "Come on," he says, striding off in the direction of his room. Dimitri hurries after him. "You paid for me. Does that mean you own me, and I have to do everything you say?" "No, child," says Simon, surprisingly pleased with the boy's bluntness. "You are not a piece of meat to be bought and sold, but you do have to do everything I say, at least until you are old enough to make decisions for yourself."
"When will that be?"
"When I decide you are ready." "Where are we going?" Dimitri looks up at him. He doesn't seem scared, just exhausted. Simon wonders if it's from the crying or the spinning. Perhaps a combination of both. What the lad did is possible, but it is also forbidden. And for good reason, it's dangerous and hard to control and can result in burnout, the bad kind, the can't-ever-spin-again kind. Simon shudders, places a steadying hand on Dimitri's shoulder, though in this moment he's not sure who he's steadying, himself or the boy. "We shall pick up my things," says Simon, "and then we'll go to the university." "Is that here?" "No, Dimitri, the university is very, very far away." Dimitri grabs Simon's sleeve, urging him to stop.
"Then I need to say goodbye. Please, sir."
Simon groans. What was he thinking? With all his other problems, now he willingly takes in a child? Idiot. Dimitri is staring at Simon, widening sad eyes at him, and Simon sighs. He wants to leave. Get out of his itchy tunic. Have a bath. But he knows firsthand what it's like, not getting a chance to say goodbye, not getting a chance to explain. "Simon, my name is Simon Septine. You may call me that." "Simon," the boy repeats. Simon takes hold of the Sela. It squirms in his grasp, but eventually complies. Accustomed to teaching, Simon makes the lines of the Sela he is twisting into the formation of a cleaning schema visible. He steps through the schema a few times, removing as much of the dust and debris from his tunic as he can. The schema holds strong, shining in front of him. Dimitri studies it curiously, reaches out as if to touch. It moves away from him, like water giving way to oil. Simon frowns, but does not say anything. There will be time to teach the boy about the Sela later. "Well, let's go say your goodbyes," he says, releasing the schema. "Lead the way." The wooden roosters begin squawking the moment they round the corner. Simon shakes his head, wondering at the joke that is his life. The hag with the flowered kerchief is waiting for them at the small gate. Dimitri runs at her and wraps himself around her tiny frame. She's so shriveled with age that he just about reaches her shoulder. She hugs him back, all the while grinning at Simon over the boy's shoulder with her sharp metallic grin. "Can't tame wild beasts, you know," she cackles. "Can't ever run away, sweet bones. Can't ever run away." She pets the lad's blonde hair, pushes him back to get a good look at him, clicking her tongue as she notices the state of his shirt. She helps him tug it into place, fingers slow and gentle. Simon watches in wonder as this witch of a woman softens into the caring shape of a grandmother. All love and no judgment. When Dimitri looks at her again, his eyes are glistening with tears, and he throws himself back into her embrace, holding on as though he doesn't know how to let go. And Simon thinks perhaps he doesn't. Perhaps this is the biggest trial of them all, leaving behind the only person who cares. He wonders briefly if he should give the boy to her. She will certainly give him more comfort than Simon ever can. But then her watery eyes, mad and piercing, find Simon's again, and he shivers, remembering the metallic jaw hidden behind her soft lips. "The Maker writes to me of you, child," says the old woman, voice coarse and rasping. She shifts her focus back to Dimitri. "My special boy, he tells me you can do great things. Did you know you could do great things? No? I have told you my little miracle. Told you, but you don't believe your Baba, do you? Believe the Maker, Dimitri. Told me himself, you know." Dimitri nods into her shoulder. "And he will guide you through any kind of dark. All kinds of dark out there. My shining boy, my golden child, trust in the Maker." Dimitri nods fervently, wiping away the last of his tears. "I'll visit you," he says. "No, no, child. I am an old woman, and my tired bones crave the soft earth. Simon will watch over you. Now run into the garden, get yourself an apple, and one for your guardian too. We are very grateful to him. After all, Dmitri goes off through the gate and around the crooked rundown cottage. You see the wooden path? Asks the woman, gesturing to round wooden slabs leading from the gate to the front door and snaking off to encircle the cottage. Simon nods. Dmitri built it for me. She narrows her eyes at him. He is a very special boy. You will take good care of my very special boy. Will you not, Simon? How do you know my name?
I heard it singing on the wind.
Simon frowns. So much superstition in this town. He nods at her, barely resisting the urge to roll his eyes. Yes. The wind. Singing. Of course. How did he not figure that out himself? She can admit she'd heard gossip. Simon will not think any less of her. But she is old, and Simon supposes he can let an old woman keep her fables.
Tell me you'll take good care, she says, voice sharp, teeth flashing in the sunlight.
I will do my best, he replies. Then, why can't he come visit you? It will be no trouble for me. She walks right up to him, this tiny shrub of a woman, and beckons him down with a crooked fingertip. He needs to bend himself nearly double for her lips to reach his ear. The Maker waits for me, sweet bones. The Maker waits for me. Now I may go. You have arrived for him, and I may finally go. Finally. Finally. It's a fine alley you stumbled onto this day. Funny how one fine alley can lead us right to our fate. No? She tips her head to the side, as though listening for something. You should trust in the Maker, too, she says. You have much good to do in your life. Though, unlike Dmitri, every scrap of light you get shall come at a price. Perhaps too high a price, but any light is worth it in your ocean of darkness. No. Simon wonders if it's okay to tell grandmothers that they are insane. Dmitri comes back, two ugly green apples clutched in his hands. He gives one to Simon, who studies it dubiously. He takes a bite out of it anyway. The apple is sweet and juicy, and Simon sighs, feeling a little bit better, a little bit calmer than he has all day. Thank you, he says to Dmitri. Abruptly overwhelmed by a rush of love for the child, he touches his blonde hair. The locks shine golden in the sunlight. A golden boy indeed. And thank you, he says to the woman, for the apple, for looking after the child, his child. Off with you, boys, says the old hag, before I change my mind and gobble up the marrow from your bones. Simon can't help but smile at her, at the sun, at Dmitri's sudden tinkling laugh. He takes the boy's hand, takes another bite of his apple, takes one last glance back at the old woman, and he can see her then, it seems, as she had been once, tall and slim and beautiful, with raven hair, much like his own, blue sparkling eyes and perfect pearly white teeth gleaming behind plump red lips, parted in a loving smile, just for the two of them, her two heroes, embarking on their first journey. Simon loves her then, keenly, as he had never loved a woman, as he never will again, at least, not for a very long time. They stroll back to Simon's room, Dmitri babbling incessantly. Simon hums and nods in all the right places, chews on his apple, smiles at the passing women in their white dresses. When they walk into his room, Philip is waiting for them. The young man is lounging on Simon's cot. Simon's mood shifts, and he frowns, shoulders going taut. Dmitri should not be here, exposed to Philip's twisted mind. Simon pulls a copper coin from his tunic pocket, crouches down in front of Dmitri, pressing it into his palm. Go find me some soap, boy. No more than a sliver, mind. And hurry back. Dmitri nods, peering at Philip curiously. Philip gives the child his most winning smile, but luckily remains silent. Go. Dmitri hesitates a moment, eyes suddenly worried. I won't leave without you, he reassures, ruffling the boy's hair. Go on. Dmitri nods, a small, tight gesture. Simon wonders how he guessed, but he supposes all children are afraid of being left behind, of being forgotten. Go, says Simon again gently, and Dmitri runs off. Looks like you've bought yourself a pet, says Philip. Get out. You and your snide remarks are not welcome here. Philip sighs, runs his palms over his face.
Look, he says after a moment.
I don't understand why you find the commission so off-putting. All the lands know your, well, history. This small favor is hardly any more distasteful than the things you have done in your short life, and I am paying you quite generously for it. Rumor has it that what little your poor grieving mother gave to you upon your exile is quickly running dry. Simon grabs the man's arm, jerking him bodily from his cot. I've already told you that I will play no part in your twisted little... He stops, steps away, turns to the window. There is Dimitri to consider now. The commission Philip is offering is more than Simon can make in a year giving lectures at the university. Perhaps even two. The Sakim may have been kinder than most when he was cast out of Sever, letting him not only finish his studies, but also offering him a job upon graduation, though he suspects both his prepaid tuition and the sizable donation for his early enrollment may have had something to do with it. And of course, getting a spinner of his strength to subject himself to teaching, well, that's quite the prize. And he is strong. Starting his education at 11 instead of 13 saved him 2 years' worth of block buildup and gave him far greater access to the Sela than that of most of his peers. Those whose parents could not afford to bribe their child's way into the university at so early an age. If his banishment hadn't had such an effect on his reputation, Simon would by now been much more than a mere lecturer. Grace, he'd be home, serving his father until his time came to sit upon Sever's throne himself. As it is, he's grateful for the little he has. Had he been in Maureen's place when the news broke, he'd have never hired himself. She'd banked, he assumes, on his students being too young to connect his name to the slaughter of Seaver's royal heirs. For the first time since his exile, he's being offered real gold, to betray a woman who, much like his own mother, has long since turned her back on him in a way that he will never turn his back on Dimitri. Simon shudders. If he does this, he will be able to get the boy books, pay half a year's tuition. On one side of a scale, there rests the fate of an entire nation, and on the other, that of a small boy. Simon places a palm onto the cottage's wooden wall. I will double your commission, says Philip. Triple it, says Simon. Done, says Philip. Done. That night, Simon puts Dimitri to sleep in his cot, wards the room, grabs his black coat, and walks out into the darkness. When he reaches the palace, Philip's serving boy is waiting for him. He leads Simon to the queen's chambers. She wakes as he pulls a chair up to her bed. He sits down slowly, purposefully drawing it out, spreads his coat around himself, rests his elbows on his knees, steeples his fingers beneath his chin. As he talks, she begins to shout for her guard, but the muffling schemas he placed on her walls keep the noise confound. She tries to spin something, but too much of a block makes her ability with the Sela weak and untrained. He snuffs it out with the ease he snuffs out candles. She tries to attack him with the blade she keeps hidden in her sheets, but it slips against the barrier he erected around her bed, like a glass case, enclosing her. If she were calmer, she might have seen it, but the queen's nerves are frail with age, or fear, or disappointment. In the end, she weeps. That is the moment that truly touches Simon. Watching the woman that had once read him stories break down before him is almost heart-wrenching. Almost. It's as though she knows that he will not back down, and Simon supposes she does. She knows him well. Even as a child, Simon never started anything he did not mean to finish. It does not take him very long, all things considered. He finds Philip waiting for him outside his mother's bedroom. Depraved and heartless, Simon thinks in disgust, as he hands Philip the signed documents in exchange for a bag of gold. As Simon watches Philip's face light up with joy, he wonders what it takes for a man to betray his mother, then thinks, perhaps he knows. The very queen might not be his mother, but years ago she came in close second. Alongside the damnation careening through his mind, Simon can also taste victory, sharp and sweet on his tongue. A powerful leader has succumbed to him, and he'd like to see anyone calling him powerless now. He'd expected to be crowned Sever's High King before his exile. Now the only title he's worthy of is traitor. He grasps at the word, clutches it tight and alive in his fist. Yes, he is a traitor. Yes, a traitor then. A monster. A dragon. And let the earth shake with his passing. He has much good to do in his life indeed. Simon laughs as he walks back to the cottage, and if anyone were awake to see it, they would have said it was a terrible thing. But Polar sleeps, unaware of the turmoil that awaits it at dawn. Simon unlatches the door as quietly as he can, walks into his room, watches Dimitri sleep for a few moments, then he packs away their meager belongings into the linen sachet, lifts it with a schema, and picks up the sleeping boy. He stirs in Simon's arms but does not wake. Simon leaves a silver mark on the bedside table. After all, he can afford it now, and carries the lad out into the night. He sleeps through Simon knocking on the building's outer wall. Sleeps through him, opening the door that unfolds in it. Dimitri shivers at the cool northern air that hits them as Simon steps over the threshold and onto Fahlahara's private door station. He turns his face into Simon's chest, hiding it from the gleaming sun, reflecting off the carved marble cliff face of the university. Simon walks into Fahlahara through the kitchen door a few feet away. It's easier than using the main entrance. He doubts much of anyone of import is awake at this hour. Still, he would rather leave awkward conversations for tomorrow. The kitchen is already alive and bustling. Cook is shouting orders and brandishing her ladle like a sword. She glances at Simon when he walks in, raises an eyebrow at the child in his arms, but mercifully leaves them be. Dimitri does wake then, lifting his nose to the smells, blinking sleepily at the noise of the kitchens. Simon knocks on an empty part of the wall, waits for the door to unfold. The door connects two points in space, collapsing the distance between them. This door he's just created turns seven flights of stairs into one step. He opens the door, walks into his room, closing it behind them with a foot. The noise from the kitchen cuts off, then the door shrinks and disappears entirely, leaving behind empty white wall. "That's what I tried to do," says Dimitri sleepily, looking over Simon's shoulder at the now bare wall. "When I exploded the hole onto you, I was trying to get away from there. I wanted to go so far they wouldn't know where to look. Thank you for doing it for me." For a moment, it feels like Dimitri is thanking him for the atrocity he's committed. But perhaps opening doors is enough for now. Simon supposes it will have to be. When you are inside a building, you can only open a door to another part of the same building. You need to be outside to open a door from one land to another, says Simon quietly. That's why your schema snapped, and because of its large volume coupled with a high frequency and decibel level, it, well, exploded. But Dimitri is asleep again, and it seems that lessons will just have to wait until tomorrow. Simon places the sachet against a wall, lays Dimitri carefully down on his bed, and unfurls a door to the storage facility. He pulls in a cot that he sets at the foot of his bed, a pillow and blanket. There's barely any room left for walking, and the cupboard will probably never fully open again, but there is enough space to get to the worn-out desk. It will do for now. Simon helps the child onto the cot, then climbs, exhausted, into his own bed. He closes his eyes. The queen's weeping face appears, and her voice, soft and spectral, whispers, "I am crying for you, Simon, not tears of fear, but tears of pity. I weep for your soul." Pushing her words away is surprisingly easy. Simon smirks. It would seem he does atrocity well. That day, for the meager price of Simon's soul, Simon gives Dimitri a musty blanket, a lumpy cot at the foot of his bed, and a single word, "home,"